WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Black opponent of apartheid. That's This Evening at 5 on All Things Considered, followed at 6:29 by 91 Report, our original news magazine. Well, with me now on Fresh Air is Robert Parker, who writes the Spencer detective novels, which are the basis of the TV series Spencer for Hire. Several critics have described Parker as the successor to Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, and Ross McDonald, a writer who has taken the hard-boiled detective tradition and updated it. Parker's detective Spencer is nearing middle age. The detective is a former cop who decided he couldn't work within the system and functions better as a loner, a private eye. Without the bureaucracy of the department, he's free to follow his conscience and his personal code. He's a former professional boxer, still lifts weights, works out, and is also a gourmet cook. The detective Spencer is a man of action who is also given to reflection on the consequences of his action. He's involved in a long-term, largely monogamous relationship with a psychologist, Susan Silverman, who's influenced by feminism, and when not wisecracking with Spencer, is frequently questioning the more macho aspects of his personal code. Novelist Robert Parker uses Spencer as the narrator of the novels and has made him a cynical and witty observer of modern life, someone who frequently quotes from his favorite novelists and poets. Robert Parker has written 13 Spencer books and has written several other books as well. Before he wrote his first book, he taught at several Boston universities. One of his courses was on the novel of violence. Parker's doctoral dissertation was a study of the private eye in the novels of Hammett, Chandler, and MacDonald. He lives in Boston, which is also the hometown of his detective Spencer. Parker's new novel is titled Taming a Seahorse, and it's published by Delacorte. Welcome back to Fresh Air.
Glad to be here again.
When you started writing the Spencer series, were you consciously trying to update the detective tradition?
No. I had no master plan. I still don't. I don't consciously think of myself as working in a tradition. I feel neither compelled nor beckoned by it. Nor do I actively reject it. It simply it exists, and people have decided I exist within it, but it had no great effect on me one way or another.
But you'd really loved a lot of the detective writers, hadn't you, both as a teacher and scholar and as just a fan?
I loved Chandler, and I probably nearly loved Rex Stout. I admired Hammett, and I read a lot. I read a lot of pulp magazines when I was a kid. For those listeners who are a few years younger than I am, which number keeps increasing each year, pulps were garish, inexpensive magazines printed on thick wood pulp paper, and Black Mask, Dime Detective, etc. They were the staple reading matter for those of us above comic book and pre-television, and it was a place where writers could learn. It's a place where Hammett started and Chandler started, and I read a great many of them and probably was influenced by writers whose names I no longer recall.
One of the things that was, I think, fairly standard in a lot of detective novels that you haven't done and that probably wouldn't make sense at all now is a certain kind of slang, you know, like dames and floozies and
Gat.
Gams and yeah heaters.
All of that, that belongs to another era. Raymond Chandler once said, if you're going to use slang, make it up, because otherwise it'll be outdated so soon. If one were to reread Chandler, who by and large followed that his own advice, one finds that it still works pretty well and is not dated. If one reads Hammett, particularly not the Maltese Falcon, but the earlier Hammett and the more typical Hammett, you find that he is dated by it, that people in his books do talk about gats and gams and bimbos and all of that. And I think there is slang in my books, but I think that I either make it up or that I draw from so it's language that is so common a part of our language that you don't notice it as slang.
Do you see Spencer having anything particular in common with Sam Spade or Philip Marlowe?
Much more in common with Marlowe, who I, you know, read often and often and still do. Did I just say I read often and often? My goodness, how the day flies by. Whom I read early and often. When I go to L.A., I frequently reread Chandler. The first time I went to L.A., I looked up Marlowe in the phone book. I knew he wasn't going to be there, but I looked him up anyway. Yeah, he was influential. I think that Hammett was less so, but Hammett was, in effect, the man who created the private eye form. He wasn't the first, but he was the major, and he took it out of. He did for detective literature what Mark Twain did for American literature. He taught us that it could be told in vernacular, and he made it available for telling serious stories. And for that, any of us who come after him owe him credit. But I think he was limited in what he could say or what he felt the need to say in a way that he lacked. Chandler once said he lacked the sound of music from beyond a distant hill, and I think he did. I think he lacked, finally, a romantic vision, which I think made Chandler a better writer. There are serious scholars who disagree with me. They're wrong, but they persist in it.
Your detective, Spencer, is a former cop, and he, you know, didn't want to work in the system anymore, and he's a freelancer, he's a private eye. That seems to be a very important part of the detective tradition in a way. There are a lot of detectives who had been cops and couldn't make it in the system. What's important about that to you?
Well, I think it's important indeed in the American literary tradition, which is rooted in a culture which was founded on people who couldn't function within the system, and which places a high premium, if one interprets that broadly, in rebelling against the system and establishing your own. Americans more than most value autonomy and starting over and beginning again and frontiers and all of those kinds of things. And whereas the European culture evolved in such a way that the system was, in fact, belonging to the system and working within it was to a large extent the goal of the average European growing up for centuries and centuries. America was created by a revolution against that very system, and consequently I think there is a tendency in the American literary response to value not only detectives who are not part of the system, but anyone who is not part of the system, and even the detectives who are, oh, say, Kojak on the television show. Kojak was a part of the police department, but what made him interesting was he was atypical and maverick and operated as if he weren't.
You've given Spencer a buddy who is his counterpart in the underworld. And I'm thinking of Hawk here, who's mm-hmm. who's an enforcer who sometimes works for Spencer, but frequently works for clients who are gangsters.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see those two as being linked in some way, the people who are hired guns for crime and the people who are private eyes?
Well, I think you imbue me with too much design and too large a sense of what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm doing half the time. I'm just typing, and it sort of works out. It's like riding a bicycle. If you don't know how, you'll fall over, but if you do know how, you don't think about it very much. I intend Hawk to be the dark side of Spencer. I intend Hawk to be what Spencer might have been if he had grown up a minority figure in a majority culture. I intend Hawk to be practical in a way that most people who have been oppressed are practical. Women are probably more practical than men. Blacks are probably more practical than whites in terms of matters of expedience as opposed to matters of scruple, and because they've learned what's important the hard way, as it were. And I have all of that in my mind. I do know, having talked to cops, that a lot of cops will say that the police gangster business is a kind of grown-up cops and robbers, a kind of game with often serious consequences. But nonetheless, I know a vice squad cop in Boston who was telling me about I don't spend a lot of time with cops. I don't know a lot of cops, and I don't know them for research purposes, but I played softball in a league with a guy who was a vice squad detective in Boston, so I knew him. He was saying that one day the previous week, he and four or five other guys from the squad were kicking in the door at a place where there was suspectedly a large cache of cocaine. And they had on the bulletproof vest and the shotgun, and they were kicking in the door. And he said, "It's fun as hell. And most of the time, nobody gets hurt, and it's fun. He said it's a kind of grown-up cops and robbers. Now and then, somebody does get hurt, and that probably adds a little piquancy to the whole affair. You know, takes it out of the realm of a game, makes it serious while it's fun.
Why don't you know a lot of cops? Why don't you hang out with them?
I don't research anyway, so I don't. In other words, I don't seek out cops to find out what's going on. I've never been in Boston Police Headquarters, for instance. So I don't know them. I know most of the cops in Lynnfield, Massachusetts, which is a small town where I lived for 25 years before I got uppity and moved into, well, actually I moved into Cambridge, which is a part of metropolitan Boston, but a separate city on the other side of the river, home to a couple of amusing universities. And so while I know a lot of cops from a small suburban community, their experience is probably in many ways different than that of a large urban police force. When I have met cops, as I say, I met this guy, the vice squad cop, because he played second base in a softball team in a league that I played with. And you play in a softball league in order to drink beer afterwards, and we'll be drinking beer afterwards, and we talked. I just guess I haven't met too many others because I didn't. You know, how many cops do you meet in your ordinary run-of-the-mill job unless you're in trouble with the law?
So you don't think it's important to do research when you're writing novels about detectives?
I think that you have to write about things you know unless you are writing romance. It is not important to write about a fictional private eye to know real private eyes because they're not in any way like fictional private eyes. What I do know, cops that I have met in the course of my work, most of them say I have got it right. I don't know how you take fingerprints other than I've had it done. And I don't, I don't know the jargon for radio calls and things. But what I do know is what men in groups are like. I've been in athletic teams. I've been in a lot of weight rooms. I've been in the Army. And I know the kind of guys who would be cops, and probably who would be robbers too sometimes. And what I've got right is the quality of their lives and the quality of their relationships and the way in which they interact and the way that they talk and don't talk. The important stuff. So what I've got, I think, is that it's true but not factual. George Higgins, for instance, got it both because he was a prosecutor for a number of years. I don't have his background.
It's interesting that you've given your detective, Spencer, usually monogamous relationship, and it means that he isn't going to have a torrid affair with every woman client who he helps out in a book. Did you think that might limit your options when you were starting to write, or that it might cut down on readers because there wouldn't be this tension, you know, about is he going to make love to her, and will she betray him, which is, pretty standard stuff in a lot of detection stories.
No, as I say, you overrate my powers of planning. I have been in a largely monogamous relationship since I was 17. And boy, if my wife ever finds out. Anyway, Joan and I have known each other since we were freshmen in college and met at the freshman dance with our signs that said, "Hi, I'm Bob Parker," and "Hi, I'm Joan Hall." And it has been the crucial event in my life, both the good parts, which are many, and the bad parts, which are bound to exist in that length of time. And I try to write about what I know. And what I know and what I care about is a long-term male-female love relationship with both its pleasures and its pangs, and that's what I wrote about. I have never so far in 13 Spencer novels, all of which are currently available at your local bookseller, thought about what the audience will want or what the reader will care about. Or I write the books that I want to read, I suppose.
My guest is novelist Robert Parker, and he writes the Spencer detective novels. His new novel is called Taming a Seahorse. You wrote in a thesis that you'd written on detective novels that in detective fiction, the crime is the occasion of the story, but the subject of the story is not the detection, but the detective.
Mm-hmm.
Does that apply to what you're writing too?
Sure.
Can you elaborate on that?
I think that people are interested in two things in most literary experiences. They are interested in the characters, and they are interested, when they're reading a book at least, in that kind of literary experience, in the sound the language makes. I don't think that people necessarily know that. necessarily would agree with it if I said so, which I just did. But I do think that that is in fact what prevails, and it is a point that's hard to make in the television and movie business, because you know everyone wants to start each film with a car chase. And I don't, in fact, think since Bullet that anyone wants to see another car chase, even if they think they do. What they want to hear is dialogue that they can respond to the way they respond to music or poetry. And what they want to see are characters about whom they care and whose relationships they can care about.
You're a writer writing about a detective. Do writers and detectives have anything in common?
They work alone, at least these kind. And the rules that they impose have to be their own. They don't have to be, but if they're not, you tend to get fragmented. Writing is safer.
Well, you've got critics
less
to contend with.
I don't read them, so you don't have to.
That sucks. You both study character, too, I guess.
I don't study character. I can't avoid paying attention to it in the same way I can't avoid paying attention to the colors in the room and the way the panels are baffled and all of that. It's not something I could ignore if I chose to. It is a point my wife always makes if she talks about me, is that I seem to be paying attention to nothing, and in fact I see almost everything, even if I don't want to. I am just the opposite of her. She tends to have a kind of laser-like concentration and can work on the project at hand in even in 10-minute spurts with total absorption, but she has no idea what's over here, no idea on the periphery. So it's one of those, we'll be driving along and I'll say, did you see? And she'll say, what? Yeah. On the other hand, if we have a problem which has to be solved, she can solve it better than I can because she concentrates on it. That's not a choice either of us has made. That's what genes and life have done to us, and that's how we are. So that, you know, James said, try to be one on whom nothing is lost. I don't think it does you any good to try. I think if you have to try, you can't. And I'm one on whom very little is lost. So I don't know whether detectives do it. My detective doesn't study it either. He's intuitive like I am.
Well, I think detectives are always following people trying not to be observed. And a lot of writers are that way, too. They want to just, like, sit in a bar and just observe things and not be noticed. But as you're getting more and more famous, that might be hard to do, especially in your hometown of Boston. Is that ever getting in your way?
The fact that you can't be invisible anymore? It doesn't get in my way as a writer. All of my conscious work as a writer takes place at my desk for 5 pages each day, more or less 5 days a week. None of it takes place sitting in bars or walking around or anything else. That doesn't mean to say I don't use what I've got. As I said, I can't keep from inhaling it all, and it gets transcribed. And when I go to write, I use what I've got. There isn't anything else to use. But I don't ever, with the exception of, for instance, if I were going to do a piece in which Spencer came to Philadelphia for an extended period of time and, you know, worked with the Philadelphia police and was around the city, I'd have to come here and walk around for a while. I've been to Philadelphia maybe 8 times, but I've done it in the way I'm doing it now. I come in for a day or two, I talk to some people, and I leave. I could have Spencer do that and see it as a passer through, but if I were going to have him do something in any extended way, then I'd have to come walk around. Other than that, I don't do any research, and consequently being noticeable, which particularly in Boston I am, is no impediment to my work. It is an occasional impediment to my leisure.
I'm going to quote something from your book, Mortal Stakes, and this is Spencer describing why he has this personal code that he follows, which you referred to a few minutes ago, and he says, being a person is a kind of random and arbitrary business, and you need to believe in something to keep it from being too random and arbitrary to handle. Some people take religion or success or patriotism or family, but for a lot of guys, those things don't work. A guy like me, I don't have religion or family, that sort of thing, so you accept some system of order and you stick with it. What about you? Do you feel like you have a family, you care about them a lot? Does it serve that function for you, that system? It does?
I tried to say yeah, nothing came out. Yes. Yes, it does. It serves fully. I would rather be her husband and their father than to be a writer or whatever.
How was TV pitched to you? Did you approach them, or did they approach you for the Spencer for Hire ABC series?
They approached us. That's not the royal we. I have two agents, one literary agent and one dramatic rights agent, who are associated in New York. The president of Warner Brothers Television, who at that time was Alan Shane, who has since moved on and has been replaced by a man named Harvey Shepard. But anyway, at the time, Alan was the president of Warner Television. It was he who wanted to put together Bob Urich and Spencer. He wanted to create the Spencer show. And he talked to Flora, who was my dramatic rights agent, Flora Roberts, and Helen, who was Helen Brand, my literary agent, about this, and could we do it? And they then negotiated the deal. And then part of that deal was that I had approval on the star and on the producer. So I went to New York, and we sat around in Flora's office, and Bob came in, and we talked. It was, in effect, an audition, but I...
This is Robert Urich came in?
Yeah. Uh-huh. But they didn't, we, you know, he didn't read for us or anything. We talked. I did approve him, and then later on, Alan and John Wilder, the producer, who had done Centennial, which is quite a feat and is still widely admired in professional television circles, enormous, admired in the way that the invasion of Normandy is admired. I mean, an enormous logistical business to do Centennial, which was, I don't know, what, 20 episodes, a huge job. And so Alan and John came to Boston, and John and I walked around the city for 3 or 4 hours and talked, and I approved him. And then they gave me money, and they made the series.
Did you ever feel that your aesthetic and financial interests were in conflict?
No. No, I have never seen any conflict in that. I work at the intersection of art and profit. It's, you know, very much more profit-oriented in Los Angeles and a little more artistically oriented in New York, where I'm published. But what I think about that is two things. One, I think that until I take the page out of my typewriter, all of the judgments made on it are aesthetic. That is this good or isn't it? Does it work or doesn't it? Once I take it out of my typewriter, then all the judgments made on it are and ought to be commercial, because then it is no longer, or it's all the art it's going to be. All the rest of the judgments made on it are not artistic judgments. All of the rest of the things and responses and changes and everything else that happened with it are made not for reasons of art but for reasons of commerce. And so the fact that those are commercial judgments has had no effect on the way it's written. Either it's art or it's not. And nobody's in my room with me when I'm typing it, and no one's telling me to do something wrong and so forth. That's what I think about the books in commerce. And what I think about television and commerce is a kind of variation on the same thing. When I have sold them the rights to use my characters, I have done so with the full knowledge they're probably not going to improve upon it, either in television or motion pictures. I don't expect them to. I'm not mad with them because they haven't. If they did make a better if the Spencer for Hire series were better than my books, it wouldn't improve my books any. The books would be either good or bad on their own. If it's worse than my books or different than my books, it doesn't hurt my books any. The books are good or bad on their own. It's essentially, I mean, I'm involved in this in a lot of ways, but essentially it is theirs. So what Spencer for Hire looked like last year and what it sounded like and when it was good and when it wasn't are the credit or fault of John Wilder, primarily. Producer's stamp is on that. John has moved on, and this year it'll be Juanita Bartlett, who did the Rockford Files, and it is her credit if it's good, and it's her fault if it's bad. The books are mine. If the books are bad, I did it, and if the books are good, I did it. And nary the twain shall meet. I can be bought easily, cheaply, but I don't do anything, you know, that has no effect on the art part of it all.
There are some, I think, pretty obvious differences between the way you'd envision the characters from reading your novels and the way they've been cast for the TV series, and between the way some of the storylines are treated in your book and on TV. Has the TV differences crystallized for you anything about, like, what TV is about? You know, like, how TV treats fiction, or, you know, the differences between books and television?
Oh, sure. I understand it a lot better than I did before I knew anything about it. It's one of the truths of life that frequently is the case. When I was a professor, I didn't know that. But I think probably the most interesting and while obvious aspect of television, I'd never quite thought of it before. Since 1974, when the Godwolf manuscript was published, I have thought up 13 ideas for Spencer stories. Since between January of 1985 and April of 1987, we'll have had to think up 44. And if we're renewed, we'll have to think of another 22 and another 22 and another 22. You work on an eight-day schedule. You shoot an episode every 8 days. It costs about $1 million a week, so if you go over another day or two, it costs you a lot of money. So at the end of 8 days, you're ready to shoot the new episode, and you shoot what you got. It could be War and Peace, or it could be... I won't use the example of a really dreadful novel, but it could be awful, and you shoot it, and the writing goes on all the time, right up to the time that till the episode is shot, gets rewritten, gets recut, it gets re-edited. You can make or break a performance out of editing. You can take a bad performance and edit it into a good one, and vice versa, so that nobody knows what the finished product is like until the thing is finally the final cut is made, and we look at it with music.
Your title is creative consultant. What does that exactly mean?
Primary function is to deposit the check. that's an exaggeration, but that is in part why one – that's why the deal was made that I consult, so I get paid for it. The deal calls for me to read scripts and make written comments. In fact, I do considerably more than that, not for free. They pay my expenses. It doesn't cost me anything, but I don't get paid for it. Which I'm perfectly happy to do. That falls into two areas. One, I have spent, I suppose maybe a total last year of 2 months in Burbank at the studio consulting and in-story conferences. To understand what I do, you have to understand a little bit about how a script gets into, how an episode gets created. And you begin with several people, three or four, depending on who's not busy, sitting around in a room thinking up a story for, let's say, an episode 3 weeks down the line. Then we call in one of the writers. There are several people who are on staff or other people who are, as it were, on call. And you say, here's our idea for a story. He joins in and you talk it out again. Then he goes back and does a treatment. Brings the treatment back. Usually you say that the treatment is just horrendous and we want the following 43,000 by count changes made in it. And he goes back and does another one, which is either good enough to go with or time is too short to change it again. He goes back and does a script, and four or five of us then talk through the script again. I've done all of that, but I have not originated the story idea, nor have I written one.
Has the existence of the television series and the actors who have been cast to play the roles affected your writing at all? Do you see Robert Urich in your mind when you're writing Spencer books now, or do you think in terms of television dialogue or anything like that? Has it affected you at all?
No, not as far as I can see. I see in my imagination the same figure I've always seen, who is not quite describable. It's interesting when you talk about casting and miscasting. No matter who we cast as Spencer, we would have disappointed some people. It is a standard subject of letter writing and a standard conversation with people at signings and things. Who would I pick to play Spencer, ideally anywhere in the world, without the realities of television, which means, say, you can't pick Laurence Olivier to play in series television. And the suggestions for who ought to play are just mind-boggling. The suggestions have ranged, let's see about the extremes. The guy that plays Remington Steele to Alex Karras. Those two pretty good extremes. Everybody and nobody. So that what people imagine, the only consensus I seem to get is if they ask me and I say, well, Robert Mitchum, when he was about 40, would have been good. And not many people disagree with that, but not many people think of him because he's no longer 40. Neither am I. But you can't predict what people will imagine. So that in casting, from my point of view, what people had in their imagination about Spencer was finally irrelevant because they had everything.
Right. My guess is novelist Robert Parker, he writes the Spencer detective novels, and they're the basis of the ABC series Spencer for Hire. He's got a new novel out, and it's called Taming a Seahorse. For years, you wrote books to support your family, but put the kids through college and everything, and you're pretty wealthy now, so you don't have to turn out a novel in the next year in order to keep the family, you know, in the standard of living that they're accustomed to. Is that
affecting
But is that affecting your writing at all? I mean, do you feel like you're not hungry anymore, and that this compulsion to write the next novel is going to have the edge taken off of it?
No, because ironically, I never did it for the money. I wouldn't do it for free. But I didn't do it to support the family and send the children to college. There's lots of ways to do that. I could have even done that, ghastly as the prospect is in retrospect, by staying a professor. It would have perhaps gone to less expensive colleges. But, you know, I could make enough money to support us all in whatever way I felt I needed to. This is a good way, and I like it, and I'm going to keep right on doing it. But since I didn't do it because out of economic need in the first place, it is the fact that my economic need has lessened doesn't have much effect on why I'm doing it now.
Did you always want to write?
Yeah. Yeah, as long as I could remember wanting to do anything in any serious way, you know, other than being a cowboy or I always wanted to be a baseball player, but I lacked the talent. I found that out one day when I was about 14 and a guy named Bart Leach threw me a curveball. And I can still remember how much I missed it by. And I knew that I'd miss it by that much every time. So, then my interest shifted to literature. But as a serious ambition, it was the only one I ever had, I guess.
What did you think you'd write?
I don't think I ever thought about it. I didn't think about it when I started writing. I wrote this without saying, I think I'll write this. I just wrote this.
You fought in Korea. And I was wondering if novels that you'd read, either detective novels or war novels or any other literature, affected your experience of the war?
Well, actually, I was there after the war ended, so it didn't have a profound effect. I mean, I heard a few... It's battle fatigue, friends. I heard a few shots fired in anger, and if I had been more imaginative, I might have thought they were directed at me, but I didn't, you know, it didn't have... There's not much to be found in a connection between the guns and my books and my being in Korea.
When you got out of the military, your early jobs included writing stuff for an insurance newsletter, I think it was, and then you had your own ad agency for a short time. Did you want out of those jobs very badly?
Oh, there's a bear asleep in the woods. Yeah, I wrote the house organ for an insurance company for a while. I wrote technical manuals for the Hawk missile system for Raytheon, which was amusing since they hadn't built the system yet, and we were writing manuals for the field maintenance equipment maintenance equipment hadn't been built for a system that hadn't been built, and we were working from schematics and blueprints, and I didn't know how to read them. So I moved on from that reasonably well. I lasted several years, but I understand how the national debt got to be what it is. A lot of that kind of stuff, I worked for Arthur D. Little Company writing industrial films. I did House Organ, you know, magazine on how somebody in Utica, New York sold $6 million worth of insurance to somebody, and all of that sort of stuff. I never liked it very much.
What was there a turning point where you said, I can't stand it anymore, I'm getting out? I mean, this is it.
There was a turning point, but I didn't say it. Joan did. She said, you can't stand this anymore, you're getting out. She said, why don't you go be a professor, then you'll have time to write. And I said, because to be a professor, you need to have a PhD. And she said, well, why don't you get a PhD? And I said, because I have a wife and children to support. Where was the liberation movement when I really needed it? It was in a time when it wasn't thought of. You know, this was in the 50s. And Joan has really been daunted by things like that. And she said, we'll do it anyway. So I did. She pitched right in and went back to school and got a master's degree. And so we were all of us were unemployed for a while. It took me a lot longer to get a PhD than I expected it to. And Joan and I went to school for years as rather mature people. I was past 30 when I started graduate school.
That was at a time when most students were in colleges were 18 to 22, and even the graduate students were mostly under 30.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you feel out of place? Did it bother you?
No, it didn't bother me particularly. It was a chance to be paternal, avuncular. You know? But I do remember I was in a seminar on Henry James given by Millicent Bell, who was a prominent Jamesian scholar. We were talking about something in James's work, which I can't remember anymore, but I had occasion to illustrate it by making reference to one of my sons who was at that time, fourth grade maybe. And one of the students who was a first-year graduate student and was probably 21, 22, said, "How old are you?" And I think probably at the time I was about 35, and I said, 35. And he said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I stayed back." But there was that kind of, I was older than some of the faculty and a lot wiser. But it was not painful. It was in many ways enjoyable, except that there was, it was a scramble because I got some money from my father. I got the GI Bill. I worked odd jobs at night and taught extra courses and wrote some freelance copy for people that I knew in the old days. And it was some of the more difficult and simple level of strenuousness years of my life. But a lot of it was fun. Graduate school was kind of fun.
You wrote your dissertation on The Violent Hero, Wilderness Heritage and Urban Reality, A Study of the Private Eye in the Novels of Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, and Ross MacDonald. And was it accepted to write a dissertation on detective fiction?
Yeah. It's accepted to write a dissertation on almost anything. The only negative comment, I think, was one professor who said one can do a first-rate study of a second-rate subject. And I proved him wrong. One can do a second-rate study of a second-rate subject. But it took me 2 weeks to write my doctoral dissertation, which is about what it's worth. It went directly from my typewriter to microfilm, unseen by human eye, where it resides, and ought to. It's a rite of passage. It's an academic hurdle to jump over. Most doctoral dissertations aren't very good. Mine isn't very good. It's all right. It's adequate. It's a long-term paper.
It sounds like it had an interesting premise, though, which is that the if I understand correctly, that the American hero has changed. Like the hero used to be in the American wilderness on the frontier, and now the American hero is in the city, and that there's different influences playing upon him. That
the
they
hypothesis
have to have different
character. The hypothesis is you've described the sequence, but the hypothesis is more the opposite. That the hero in American culture is a figure of mythology, and that he remains largely unchanged. His values are rooted in the wilderness and the frontier rather than American culture. As the culture changed, he is forced to adjust his behavior but not his values. That's about what I said in the dissertation, except it took me 175 pages. The dissertation would make a very good essay. An extended treatment of that subject has been done much better than I ever did it by Leslie Fiedler in Love and Death in the American Novel and by a number of other people like R.W.B. Lewis in The American Atom, et cetera. It got me the PhD and sprang me loose and got me tenure and got me teaching 9 hours a week, which left a few moments over to write.
We obviously spent a lot of time thinking about the American hero and the American detective. What about the British detective tradition, like Sherlock Holmes, for instance? How do you see that comparing with the American tradition?
Well, it has no connection other than a kind of arbitrary and artificial one. I or Raymond Chandler have much less in common with Edgar Allan Poe, let's say, than we have in common with Hemingway, who has nothing in common with Poe either. I mean, there are two. To stick with detective fiction for a moment, the so-called British school, epitomized, I suppose, by Sherlock Holmes, presumes a sort of 18th-century universe. The classic image of the universe in the 18th century was of the creation of a great watchmaker wound up and set ticking in an orderly and integrated fashion. Philadelphia is an 18th century city. It's laid out almost geometrically, as opposed to Boston, which is a 16th century city and is laid out like a cow pasture. So tangled. The detective in that kind of a book is irrational. He occupies a place in society that the great watchmaker in the sky occupies in the cosmos. Crime is a deviation from the norm. And the detective's job is through the use of superior reason to right that wrong and bring order back into its normal position and put chaos aside. People like Chandler, let's say, because I'm too modest to talk about myself, that's why I'm here. People like Chandler grew out of a whole other tradition, the same tradition that that Hemingway grew out of, and it goes back to Mark Twain as much as anything. If Mark Twain had lived through the First World War, he'd have been more like Hemingway and more like Chandler, in that in the First World War, that 18th century universe, rational universe, blew itself up, and no thinking person after that could walk around saying, yes, this is a rational universe, an orderly place, or at least a lot of thinking people couldn't. And consequently, the detective in the American style, hard-boiled, whatever you prefer, lives in a world in which random violence and chaos are probably the norm. His job is not to restore order, because that's not possible, but at least to carve out a little niche of momentary stay against confusion. And he does it not through his superior rationality, but through being tough enough to stick at it. He's more like Huckleberry Finn than he is like Cardinal Newman in that. He's not more knowledgeable, but he's outside. And it's what makes it possible for him, probably, because he stays outside.
I guess there's class differences in a way, too, you know? Like the British detective series, I wouldn't imagine Sherlock Holmes to start getting into a fist fight with someone. He's highly educated.
There's a whole assumption about the nature of existence, which includes being hierarchical and structured and systematic and orderly and rational. The age of science, the belief that all things were rational and possible in the 18th century, it's the framers of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution were 18th century rationalists.
Did you like teaching when you were teaching at the university?
In a word, no. Somebody asked that of a writer named Tom Williams, who had been teaching at the University of New Hampshire once, and Williams' response was, "I got tired of explaining." Asked him why he quit teaching. And I got tired of explaining subjects to people who weren't interested in the explanation, mostly. That was tiresome, but more than anything else, I really did not enjoy my colleagues, by and large. There are obviously some glaring exceptions. It's like poetry. The best and the worst writers in the world write poetry. If you want to write a bad sonnet, it doesn't take very long. If you want to write a good one, sometimes it does. But the best and the worst people in the world teach, I think. In college, I have no strong views on public school teaching, except that you probably get what you pay for in public school teaching. But in the university, most of my colleagues seemed to care very little about the subject and very little about the students, which left them a lot of time to care a very great deal about tenure and promotion. It seemed sort of an aimless waste of energy. There was a tendency in my experience that it mattered greatly not only that you get tenure but that someone else not get it. You know, it's the old line. It matters not only that I succeed but that my friends fail. I thought they were an unseemly lot by and large, and I didn't like it very much.
When did you start writing?
I started the first novel in November of 1971.
While you were still teaching?
Oh, sure, yeah. And as soon as I got the PhD and got tenure and got to be a professor and was teaching 9 hours a week, it was time. Before that, I had been scrambling around with graduate school and teaching and keeping everybody alive. So I got my PhD in the previous June. I guess it must have been June of 71. And started the novel that fall.
Were your colleagues supported when you started to write books?
My colleagues didn't matter. They neither supportive nor non-supportive.
Did they know? Did you tell them?
Some I told, some I didn't. What's more interesting to me in retrospect was after I published the first novel, a large number of my colleagues undertook to write a novel as well on the presumed assumption if that nitwit can do it, you know, anybody can do it. Only one of them succeeded. But anyway, one of my friends who was still a professor and who is one of the exceptions to all of those above complaints did bring out a novel and is working on another one.
When were you able to quit teaching? You obviously didn't like it very much. You wanted to quit. Was it when your book started making enough money?
My detractors say I quit teaching immediately upon starting. But I stopped teaching. Well, I took a sabbatical, and then I took a leave of absence. So I probably had ceased to be a regular attendee in the classrooms about 1976 or 7. I resigned officially on January 1st, 1979, and haven't taught since.
The detective that you write about, Spencer, used to be on the police force and left the police force because he didn't want to be in the system. Was leaving the university the equivalent for you?
No, getting into the university was the equivalent of leaving the system in some sense. Getting out of Prudential Insurance Company of America, et cetera, was getting out of the system. And the university is, by and large, a haven for people who aren't particularly happy with the system. The universities, some of the good things about universities, I know that many professors don't think so, but some of the good things about universities frequently are the administrators. Universities pretty much leave you alone, probably in many cases more than they ought to. I mean, some of the silliest things in the world get permitted in universities, but you can do pretty much what you want to in a university. It would be nice if while you had that freedom, you also were a good teacher or a good researcher or a good scholar or something. But that was the escape from the system. Quitting the university was just the escape from the university, which I found a little tiresome too. I like autonomy.
My guest is novelist Robert Parker. He writes the Spencer detective novels. His new one is called Taming a Seahorse, and the novels are also the basis of the ABC TV series Spencer for Hire. Why did you decide to continue the same character through a series of books instead of, first of all, not writing about a detective anymore or writing about a different detective?
It was not a decision so much as I failed to decide not to. That is, when I finished the Godwolf manuscript and sent it off to the publisher to see if anyone would publish it, I immediately set out and began writing another novel, and it was also about Spencer. That wasn't an active decision, though in retrospect it seems a good one. That is, I don't really understand why more people don't do it. William Faulkner did it. I do it. There's a nice combo. Later I'll link myself with Keats and Shelley. But it seems to me that it gives you a grand opportunity to look at character and rework it and let it develop as you do. Again, I don't have a master plan. I'm not saying 2 years down the line Spencer's going to have matured into A, B, or C. But I've been doing this now since 1971. And during that period, I've aged about 15 years. I know I don't look it, but I have. And in aging, I have changed. My children have grown up. I've learned things from them. If you don't change in 15 years, what happened? You know, so that it gives you an opportunity to evolve, to let the characters evolve, to let earlier life impinge upon later life as it does in the actual world. I'm glad to do it. I occasionally do an out-of-character, an out-of-genre, I think is the official publishing term, book. I did Wilderness. I did Love and Glory. I did the book with Joan called 3 Weeks in Spring, all of which are in print and available except except 3 Weeks in Spring, which is out of print, and I don't know where you can get a copy either. That question always comes up, and I'll let you know now that I don't know.
I'm sure a lot of your readers wonder if you've ever secretly wanted to be a detective yourself.
No, I'm doing exactly what I want to do. I've done everything I ever wanted to do. There's a line in a Frost poem, let no God misunderstand me and snatch me away too soon. You know, I want to keep doing it. I don't want to hang it up yet. This is not my valedictory address. But I have, there isn't anything that I wish I had done that I haven't. I don't want to be a detective. I want to write detective stories.
Did you know that when you were reading detective stories when you were young? Why did you want to be a writer and not a detective when you were first reading this stuff?
Well, I was a better typist than I was a shot, I guess. I think that is in part probably the expectations of parent and family and all. That is, I think that it would have been perfectly plausible prospect for me to have become a cop if I had come from a socioeconomic circumstance in which becoming a cop was something that you were supported in. Or I don't mean I wanted to be a cop and people told me not to. But if I said to someone, you know, it might be kind of interesting to be a policeman, then I'll say, You know, we didn't send you to college to be a policeman, sort of thing, or whatever. It was not the kind of thing one did. So it was never a serious issue. And that's too bad. It happens to a lot of kids. In my case, it worked out well because I'm doing something I'd rather do. But a lot of kids get tracked onto a certain, you know, it's more important to wear a suit than to do work that you like. I should think it would be much better to be a cop than to be a cog in a large office equipment sales force. I think it would be much better to be a carpenter, which I have some experience with, than to buy and sell stocks and bonds. They make things. They do something. Being a cop is sort of useful sometimes.
So your family didn't want you to be a cop, huh?
Well, I'm glad that you saw the delicate nuances that I placed on that. I don't think they did. I don't think that if I had become a cop, they'd have disowned me. It's not that anyone told me not to. It's that the question never really came up. It's not something that one occurred to any more than perhaps your family. I mean, did you ever think of being a bartender, you know, when you were a kid growing up? I don't know what your circumstances were, but it's the kind of thing that someone who is in NPR probably wasn't from circumstances which said, yeah, maybe it could be a bartender. It's a good idea. You just never think of it. And in some sense, it's probably a class distinction that is made there. And and the issue never really arose.
Most of your books have been dedicated to your wife, Joan.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you went through a period of separation
mm-hmm.
for a while. Did that separation coincide with the separation of the two main characters,
mm-hmm.
Spencer and Susan Silverman, in your novels?
Yes, yes, and yes.
Did you write it in that way for emotional reasons? Or
I wrote it in that way because that's what I had and because it was an opportunity to do things that made sense. That is, heroes have to deal with something other than bad guys. I can only write what I know, and when I know about emotional loss and separation, I can use it. And so I do. I write about parent-child relationships because I know about that, and I can use that. So I do. This doesn't mean that the separation that Susan and Spencer had was like the separation that Joan and I endured, nor does it mean that Paul Jackman in Early Autumn, say, is like one of my children. But it does mean that I take what experience I have and I filter it through my imagination and I make it into fiction. But you wouldn't learn a hell of a lot about the biographical data of my life from reading my books.
How does your wife feel about being, in some very loose way, the inspiration probably for Susan Silverman?
Well, I think she likes that. I think probably she would prefer to be interesting to people because she is interesting rather than because she is the inspiration of a fictional character.
So that could lead to problems right there.
Not between us, but it can lead to problems in public places where people tend to push her aside and talk to me.
Do you eat a lot of gourmet food like people assume that you do since you write so much about food in your novels?
You know, what do you want to eat? What do you got? The whole food thing and cooking and stuff is, it seems to me, canted by the fact that I'm male. For years, Joan worked and I stayed home and typed, so I cooked. It seemed the height of lunacy for her to come home at 6 o'clock at night and get supper ready when I'd been sitting there all day, not getting supper ready. I like to cook, okay. I mean, who loves it, you know? But I can cook, and I like to cook. And if you cook, you know, it's not brain surgery. You can cook whatever you feel like cooking. And if you can't cook, it's because you haven't tried. If I were a woman, I would be perceived as one who made supper. But since I am male, I am perceived as one who is a gourmet of some sort. I'm not. I like good food very much, and I like bad food very much. I like the food in the Army. You know? I also like the food at the Four Seasons in New York. I mean, it's different strokes for different folks, depending on where you are and what your wallet looks like, I guess.
Do you ever want to try to write the great American novel? You know how a lot of actors who are, like, really terrific on television or in the movies, if you ask them about their acting, they say, yes, but one day I really want to star in Macbeth.
Mm-hmm.
And you
mm-hmm.
almost wonder why, because mm-hmm. they're really good at what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if, like, one day you want to write a quote, serious novel.
I have. I already did that 13 times now. They're all serious. I'm serious about them. and I think they're good. And I have no, well, let me answer the question anecdotally, which is to say that when I wrote Wilderness and when I wrote Love and Glory, people would say, oh, well, you know, you're trying to do a serious work, or you've gone straight, or you're whatever. And I don't think they're either better than worse than the other novels. They're just different. Spencer is, if there's art involved, my art. I do it to my own satisfaction almost every time. And I hope to continue doing it. I wouldn't want to stop. I don't think that I know how to evaluate. I mean, it's like someone said about music. There's either good music or bad music. That's all there is. There isn't good rock or whatever. And I think that's true of books. There's either good books or bad books. And I don't think that the other distinctions are useful to writers. I think they are useful to other people, and I don't mean that as if they shouldn't be. To be able to categorize my books in a way is very handy for booksellers and reviewers and publishers. And bookstore owners who have to stock shelves. And if everyone knows that they want my books, they look under detective or mystery headings, that's fine with me. But that fact is relevant only in that way. I'm doing the same thing. I go through the same process. I make the same effort. My goals are the same, let's say, as Faulkner's were. The results are different because Faulkner's imagination is larger than mine. I mean, he's a better writer. He's a better imaginer. I couldn't do what he can do. He probably could do what I can do. That's simply a fact of, you know, I also can't fly. It's like the law of gravity. I don't feel bad that Faulkner's better than I am. He's better than anybody else, too. But beyond that, I go through the same thing he does, and I don't think there's any distinction from the part of the person who makes it.
I still don't think I fully understand what it is about the character of the detective who works alone, who works for free sometimes because he's so committed to the case that the money is almost irrelevant. He knows this person. He has this need to protect them. How that character of the detective appeals to you? Why you've gotten so emotionally and professionally involved with that character? How does that relate to you?
Pays good. You're not buying that one, huh?
No.
Well, let's see. First of all, let's turn it around a little bit. I don't think he has a need to. I mean, one of the points about some of the things that anyone that Spencer will do, let's say, is he might help someone whom he has no need to help, who doesn't particularly deserve help, but who needs help, and who, if Spencer doesn't help them, won't get any help. It's easy to help people for whom you need to help. If you have a need to do things for people, that's relatively easy to do because you're fulfilling your own needs. And in, as such, then it becomes a kind of self-serving enterprise. Spencer frequently helps people that he doesn't need to help. And he helps them because they need help. And because if he doesn't, who will? How does that relate to me? I have no idea. If I did, I probably wouldn't say. It's sort of unseemly at some point for authors to spend too much time explaining their connection to their books. But in perfect truth, obviously, they grow out of my unconscious, which by definition is not available to me to tell you about. I don't know. Autonomy certainly is appealing to me. He's autonomous, and I find that a desirable thing to be.
One last thing. In your Spencer books, which is about a real, you know, manly man, very muscular and very strong. There's always this counterpoint of Susan, who, you know, has read a lot of feminist literature, is, you know, pretty independent, and is always very willing to point out the flaws in the kind of macho behavior that Spencer is prone to. And I wonder if anything similar has happened in your life, if there's that kind of back and forth in your life between...
Well, certainly what I know about superior women I have learned from being with one for so long. But keep in mind that the books that get read in my books are books that I have read. You know, if Susan has read feminist literature, it's because I know it, obviously, because I make her up too. And, you know, so if she references Simone de Beauvoir, it's because I've read a little of that. I don't, certainly I respect the individuality of males and females, and I want the books to be about someone who is, after all, imperfect. You know, we're not talking Superman here. Maybe Spider-Man, but not Superman. And Susan highlights that and helps him understand himself. And sometimes she's wrong, of course. You know, sometimes she doesn't understand him as well as she thinks she does.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been novelist Robert Parker. He writes the Spencer detective novels. His new one is called Taming a Seahorse. It's just been published by Delacorte. And the Spencer novels are also the basis of the ABC TV series Spencer for Hire, which has been renewed for how long?
Full order, 22 weeks, Saturday nights, 10 o'clock.
Oh, it's moving?
Yeah, it's moving.
That's been a long-term detective time. Is it going to be up against...
I don't know what they're putting up against it yet. I mean, I know what's on, but I don't know if it'll stay.
Do you watch it every week?
No.
You don't watch your own series every week?
Well, it's not mine.
It's not yours, and that's why you don't watch it?
I watch it sometimes and not others.
Yeah. One last thing. If you watch Spencer for Hire very much, would it rub off on you too much? Do you intentionally not watch it?
No, I just don't watch it because I'm not home all the time or because there's a ball game on.
Come on, you could tape it.
I don't have a VCR.
You could buy one. You've got the money. I mean,
you've
you don't want to watch
pinned
it.
You've pinned me to the wall. No, I don't want to go to the trouble of, I mean, it doesn't matter to me if I watch it every time or not. If there's a ball game on or if I'm reading or if I'm out, I don't watch it. If I'm home and it's on, I do watch it.
Okay. Robert Parker, thank you again for being with us. And Robert Parker's new novel is called Taming a Seahorse. It's 3 minutes to five. We'll be joining National Public Radio at five for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening next week on Fresh Air after we check in with Shadow Traffic.
First off, east on the Schuylkill Expressway, a 10-minute delay approaching Conshohocken and then jammed between the Boulevard and Girard westbound now. Almost an hour delay between Vine Street and the Gladwin area. North on 95, jam traffic between Cottman Avenue and Academy. There's an accident off on the shoulder. Into New Jersey, jam the entire length of the Walt Whitman Bridge down to Route 295 at 42. Also, 73 southbound, very congested between Route 38 and 295. An accident now in Laurel Springs at Warwick and Laurel. On the PA Turnpike westbound, it's about a 7-mile traffic jam west of the Downingtown Interchange. Only one lane getting by out there, repaving till 9 o'clock tonight. That's Shadow Traffic, and I'm John Butterworth on 91 FM, WHYY.
That Shadow Traffic Report was funded by Photomat. This Sunday at 6 on the Best of Fresh Air, my guest will be songwriter Ellie Greenwich, who wrote a lot of the girl group hits, including To Do Ra Ron, Be My Baby, and Chapel of Love. Monday afternoon at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by writer Deborah Eisenberg, who's the author of a new book of short stories called Transactions in a Foreign Currency. And at 4 o'clock, we'll feature the Marion McPartland Piano Jazz Series with her guest, Nellie Lutcher. Tuesday at 3, we'll be joined live by pianist George Shearing. Wednesday afternoon at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by soul singer Solomon Burke. This Thursday afternoon at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by Paul Rudnick, author of the new novel Social Disease, which is a humorous look at the trendy New York City club scene. And at 4 o'clock, we'll be joined by Karma Hinton, an American who lived in mainland China until she was 21. She now makes documentaries about Chinese villages. And that's some of the things coming up next week on Fresh Air, so I hope you can be listening. That about does it for today's program. Joyce Lieberman was our engineer. Thanks to Marty Morse-Cohen for helping us out the last 2 days, and Marty Morse-Cohen is also the producer of Family Matters. Our interns, Abby Klebanoff and Tom Cellini. Amy Salad is the associate producer of Fresh Air. Danny Miller and I, the producers of the show. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have a very good evening. This is WHYY FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Nina Totenberg.
This is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
The U.S. has never been seen in such a negative light ever by a black South Africa as it is now.
the Reverend Alan Busack, leader of South Africa's United Democratic Front, appealing for strong U.S. actions against South Africa. Tonight on All Things Considered, the debate on U.S. policy towards South Africa heats up again.
And these stories, the South African government cracks down on dissidents and on the press.
Miranda at 20, a Supreme Court anniversary.
A scandal at the top of the Panamanian government and a dilemma for the U.S.
Gaddafi on TV, a strange and strained performance.
A delayed ticker tape parade in Chicago for Vietnam vets.
A harpsichord convention.
And children's opera.
First, this hour's news.
This is Lori Waffenschmidt. In South Africa today, President P.W. Botha met Bishop Desmond Tutu for the first time. Afterwards, Bishop Tutu described the 90-minute meeting as frank and cordial, but said there was major disagreement over the state of emergency declared yesterday in South Africa. Tutu warned that Monday's anniversary of the Soweto uprising could become violent if the white minority government continues jailing black leaders.